this week. Investors took some profits off the table amid hawkish comments from the Fed. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you again this week. And Fed Chair Dr. Yellen surprised the markets with slightly hawkish comments this week. It caused some portfolio readjustments, but nothing major. Joining me with their thoughts on the precious metals sector and the economy, one of the most accurate financial prognosticators, Louis Navalier of Navalier & Associates. He returns with bullish comments for equities investors. He says U.S. stocks have entered a melt-up period, echoing comments from our recent guest, Ralph Acampora. A major factor in the U.S. stock rally, bond issuance. Companies are simply buying back their shares using debt that they're selling on the market. And the presidential election cycle seems to be improving the outlook for equities. Plus, he has positive comments for gold investors, noting that every portfolio needs that diversification-free lunch, and he shares one of his favorite precious metals mining companies. Next, Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff from Boston University says our country is, well, I quote here, flat broke. The national debt is at least 10 times the current official level, somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 trillion. He blames entitlement programs, noting that they're really just Ponzi schemes. He shares a free 157-page book, which he claims will solve all of our economic troubles. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the precious metals this week. The yellow metal fell only about $20, ending at $13.25, but silver dropped 57 cents, about 3%, ending at $18.75, off the lows. The precious metals XAU shares were off $12, about 11%, ending at $95.80, while West Texas Intermediate crude dropped $1.70 per barrel, closing just above $47.33, giving back about 3.5%. Still, black gold appears to be shadowing the CRB, building a bullish pattern with a target of at least $70 a barrel. In related news, Federal Reserve Chairwoman Janet Yellen's speech at the Kansas City Fed's annual economic symposium at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, noted that the case for a rate hike had strengthened recently. In addition, two Fed governors also hinted at rate hikes at the Jackson Hole meeting. However, investors didn't buy any of the talk. They're not expecting a rate hike until December, according to the current Fed Funds Futures contract. Moving on, downbeat economic numbers, including a U.S. consumer sentiment report, indicated an August reading that dropped more than expected, falling below 90 in July. In addition, news that the U.S. economy was growing at a rather sluggish level of only 1.1% in the second quarter caused some alarm among some investors. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, the slightly hawkish tone by Fed officials clearly boosted the U.S. dollar, which put some temporary pressure on the safe haven assets. However, the current pullback, I think, is pretty typical during the August lull. Seasonal trends suggest that retailers and manufacturers will likely start adding to their precious metal stockpiles in anticipation of the upcoming holiday season. In addition, the dollar remains below support while gold remains above support, all very positive on a forward basis. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly cloudy skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange on news of hawkish comments from the Fed chair. The Dow Jones Industrials gave back 157 points for the week, finishing at 18,395, off less than 1%. The S&P 500 gave back 15 points, closing at 2170, while the NASDAQ dropped about 20 for the week, finishing at 5218. A top story moving the U.S. shares this week emerged from the Commerce Department. Consumer spending was revised upward from 4.2% to 4.4%. Of course, consumer spending comprises 75% at least of U.S. GDP, so happy consumers tends to translate into solid corporate earnings and firm share prices. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, the greed fear index remains at highly frothy levels. Much of the excesses have been removed, suggesting that investors could start bargain hunting in the coming days and weeks. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek Radio with our two big guests and Robert Ian. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Louis Navalier runs Navalier & Associates. Welcome back, Louis Navalier.
Thank you.
You've given folks advice for over a decade on GoldSeek.com radio. This year you were a bit pensive on U.S. equities. You'd felt they'd run a bit far too fast, getting ahead of earnings, which weren't terribly robust, but no need to panic yet. Your advice has been spot on. Do you think with this really odd period of low volatility that we've seen over the past few weeks, are we gearing up for a new push to record highs in the U.S. indices?
We're melting up, and this will be clarified on Friday, August 26th, when Janet Yellen confirms that the Fed's less likely to raise rates. The main reason we're melting up is we had record bond issuance in August, and companies are going to take all that money they raised and refinance their existing balance sheets, pay down their existing debt with the new cheaper debt, and continue to buy their stock back. The winner of the low interest rate environment is the stock market. The stock market yields over 2%. That's well above the 10-year treasury at 1.55. And as long as we have this low interest rate environment, the stock market will continue to melt up from buybacks. We also seem to be in a typical presidential election year cycle, where what's essentially going to happen is we're going to rally going into the elections because they're all going to be out sucking up to us, entertaining us. And then we'll luck somebody, and we might have a little buyer's remorse after that, but we'll cheer up around Thanksgiving, have a nice year-end rally. Markets are seasonally strong then. And then we go into the new year, and then every new president will get a 90 to 120 days, and then before we have any remorse. That will be the pattern we're going to follow, so it looks pretty good through April.
You've brought up the idea again of bond issuance, and of course this is where corporations are selling debt for virtually nothing. I mean, they don't have to pay any serious interest on their debt, a modicum of interest, and that gives them the opportunity then to buy back capital, their own shares, which of course reduces the supply outstanding in the market, boosts equities. That's been your thesis now for years, and it's certainly held true. Doesn't it take more, though, than just stock buybacks to send shares higher, and even, enthusiasm over the November election?
We're starting to have better than expected earnings. There's still a bit of a sales issue. A good example is J.M. Smucker beat on earnings today, but sales are disappointing. So they hit the stock. Personally, I think Smucker's fine. It's just another example. A company can buy its stock back and boost its earnings. And the food prices are low, so they make money just being in the food business, so does Tyson Food and other food companies. Going back to the real issue here is the stock market's dying. It's actually disappearing. It's actually shrinking. And it's all being fueled by the buybacks and the balance sheet restructuring. The central banks did something significant. The Bank of Japan has doubled their quantitative easing. The Bank of England has had to cut rates and has another rate cut coming, plus then now they have negative rates 2 years out. And then the European Central Bank, of course, has negative rates. But both the Bank of England and the European Central Bank have joined the Bank of Japan to authorize corporate debt buybacks with their quantitative easing. So initially the quantitative easing was only in government debt, and now it includes corporate debt. So a lot of your buying pressure for the corporate debt is coming from the central banks themselves, not our Fed, but the other central banks. So money sloshes all around the world. There's this worldwide limbo contest, whose rates can go the lowest. You've got over $13 trillion of government debt now with a negative yield. And so the people are naturally going to corporates. And now you have an earnings recovery. The earnings sales and earnings are still negative, but if you throw out energy and financials, they're positive. So we might have a little glitch with energy. Natural gas is looking very good because of the hot summer. Farmer's Almanac has forecasted a freezing cold winter. That's actually a reliable source, something to do with sunspots and things. So natural gas is looking very promising, but we have a glut of gasoline. We expect crude oil prices to be slipping big time come September after Labor Day. So there's going to be some glitches out there that are going to derail the market. But, gold, you brought up precious metals. Gold, I think it's best 6 months since 1980, the first half of this year. A lot of it's coming from increased pressure from ETFs because gold zigged when everything zagged this year. Gold is getting a bigger allocation, okay? Obviously, silver's an amplified gold. But I think the precious metals rally is largely due to the lack of confidence in central banks. And our Fed seems to be losing control of the situation. I think they're going to basically say because of falling rates, deflation, lackluster economy, they're pretty close to normal, and that's what Yellen will clarify in her Jackson Hole speech.
You know, our Fed policymakers taking a hawkish stance. We went from virtually no odds of a rate hike for the next 11, 12 months to stronger odds now by as soon as about 50-50 odds by December of this year, and then it starts to actually increase into January, February, March of 2017. Can you give us some ideas why the Fed funds futures don't jibe with the policymaker?
Well, the Fed fund futures are everything. I would listen to them more than I listen to the Fed. I have a joke that the Fed can't hit the broadside of the barn. If you remember in December, they said inflation's coming back, we got robust economic growth, so we're going to raise rates four times. Then in March, they came out and said, because they update these things quarterly, well, I don't see the inflation, economy's not as strong, so we're only going to raise rates two times. Then basically what happened is they are now going to admit here again that maybe one rate increase, August 26th, they might admit it's going to be none. If they do increase rates, it'll be in December. It'll be another one and done, just like it was last year. But right now, market rates have come down, so there's no reason for the Fed to raise rates. And again, we're going to have a lot of deflation news. We have producer prices fell 0.4%, consumer prices were flat, and now we got a collapse in crude oil prices and gasoline prices coming in September. A lot of it's seasonal in nature, but it will affect the inflation numbers.
This concept of seasonal trends within energy, is this a reliable indicator? Would it be something that in the past you've counted on to make investment decisions?
I think the Farmer's Almanac is more important for natural gas. Obviously, what the Farmer's Almanac is looking at is the sunspots, the lack of solar activity. They're worried about a new marauder minimum. It's a weather pattern that lasts some of the sunspots slow down. If the sunspot activity flares up, then it's all going to change again. There is a problem with the jet stream and oscillations. So you can have one part of the United States cold, another hot. The sunspot is what the Farmer's Almanac is referring to, and that's actually pretty legit. It sounds kind of corny and hokey, but there's some actual science to it that's a little bit better than most. The wild card for the farmers is the oscillation of the jet stream. You know, these farmers have hybrid seed, so we have record corn production. We have very resistant wheat. We are growing corn farther north than ever before. Our wheat fields are more productive. The wheat, corn, soybean production in the United States is very, very strong. Somewhat's due to the weather. A lot of it's due to the hybrid seeds that they now have.
Our listeners are keen to hear your thoughts on whether or not this remarkable nearly 200% advance in the XAU, despite current weakness in a couple of weeks or so. But we're starting to see some signs in the technicals, you know, the 50 and the 200 period moving average in the weekly chart, suggesting that maybe the worst has passed from this five-year correction in the metals. Any comments?
Yeah, I think the biggest problem with metals is you have your own cycle, too. You know, you have the Indian wedding cycle. And so you've got 6 months of the year where you got hot and heavy demand, and then the rest of the year where demand cools off. But the demand for gold that's investment-related is steadily rising, and a lot of it's coming from GLD, the gold ETFs. Again, what happened is when things were oscillating early in the year, gold wasn't. It was zigging when things zag, so it shows up in all these allocation models. And they're buying it for GLD, and that's what's got physical gold demand up, and that's why the first 6 months of the year were the strongest since 1980. The knock against gold is it doesn't have interest. Well, guess what? No interest is better than negative interest. So I think that a lot of the demand for gold is investment-related, and I think the lack of confidence in central banks is boosting gold demand.
We have about $13 trillion in negative sovereign debt floating around the world, and that's increasing at a really solid clip. So, you know, with $4 trillion in pension funds searching for better than negative returns, certainly that's played a big factor in gold's rally as well as U.S. equities. It's, in other words, it seems to be the only game in town. Short covering, I'm sure, has to be a big aspect of this year's advance.
Absolutely. The biggest problem we have with financial markets is correlation. And when things move in tandem, the diversification argument is it undermines the argument for diversification. But the good news is when things are moving, gold's not moving in tandem with them. It zigs when the thing zags. So the question is, how much gold do you have to add to your portfolio to smooth out all the bumps and gyrations out there? And gold has certainly gotten a bigger allocation. And even some of the gold stocks, when I run my reports, I see lots of gold stocks. I would rather people own physical gold than the gold stocks, but I'm known to recommend a couple of gold stocks now, like Harmony, HMY.
Really, what gold does is it allows you to, I think, encapsulate that free lunch that's been referred to after Markowitz, and that is the free lunch that we have through diversification. It's just one of those hallmarks of successful investors. It helps you balance your betas in the portfolio, boost your expected return while lowering volatility. It's a win-win. Those are the two keys to investment success.
I'm very proud that I have a lot of products that are top rated. My small cap growth is top rated now in pension investments the last 5 years. So is my power dividend portfolio. I'm top rated in tactical ETFs, 1 and 2, Morningstar. Basically, we've been top rated by being picky. The markets have been too narrow. Just like you had to buy gold, like when you go to retail, you had to buy Ultra Salon and fragrances. When you buy dividend yield, you got to buy dividend companies that boost their dividends. It's still a shockingly narrow market out there. And, you know, on our websites, we have dividend graders, portfolio graders, and we encourage people to get portfolio checkups so they can be in the creme la creme. As this market went higher, only 2 of the 10 sectors were leading the way. I'd rather own the leading stocks in these key sectors than the whole market. So I know a lot of people are complacent now because they think we're in a bull market. They think the S&P is doing well. They're happy the S&P yields more than the alternatives. But I want to warn people that as this thing goes higher, it's going to get more narrow. So I still think people should get portfolio checkups and invest in the creme la creme. I have 2 websites that people can view. My management company is Navalier.com, and my newsletter site is NavalierGrowth.com. Free databases on each newsletter site. There's a free newsletter called Market Mail on Navalier.com. We put a lot of our research free in the public domain because we're trying to help people. So that's what we would encourage people to do. We like to use our databases to grade your stocks, and hopefully you just have what we call A and B graded stocks, which are strong buys or buys. You know, I think it's very important to stay in the creme la creme. On Navalier.com, we show you the performance of our graders, and they're very, very impressive. So you want to take advantage of our free services. Our private client group gives free portfolio checkups for people all the time, and we're happy to do more in-detail research as well if you want to talk to somebody at our firm.
Well, without hyperbole, simply the best advice. We appreciate your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's featured guest. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garnero, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes 3 deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff, professor of economics at Boston University, author of Clash of the Generations, as well as the Inform Act. Let's start off with this idea that our U.S. government is broke. We don't owe $18 trillion in national debt. The figure, as you say, is 15 times larger, at least somewhere around $200 to $220 trillion. You know, we just keep putting off the day of reckoning.
Well, first of all, we can fix the lying by telling people the truth about our fiscal position, especially our children, because we've really engaged in six decades of taking from young people and giving to old people, very much a Ponzi scheme or a chain letter. And the way we've done this and kept it off the books is we've taken money from younger people and said, look, we're going to call this tax, but when you're old, we're going to pay you a lot of benefits in exchange for this money. And we're going to call those benefits Social Security benefits, Medicare benefits, and Medicaid benefits. But so don't worry that we're calling this stuff taxes, payroll taxes, but because we're really borrowing the money and we're going to hand it back to you in the future. And you can trust us to do that because so many of you are going to be relying on it. And obviously, it's going to be politically impossible for us to do anything but pay you off. So this is an example of, in effect, borrowing from the public and not putting it on the books, because the use of the word taxes to take the money from younger people means that the promises in the future to these transfer payments aren't recorded as part of an official liability. You can see that this is, if you play this game enough, you will end up with an enormous set of bills off the books, of debts, of liabilities. And that's what we have. So our true indebtedness as a country is $199 trillion. It's not the $19 trillion in gross debt that Donald Trump's been talking about, or the $13 trillion in debt that's in the hands of the public after the Federal Reserve has printed a lot of money and bought back about $5 or $6 trillion worth of debt. So it's really $199 trillion. That's calculated. That's called the Infinite Horizon Fiscal Gap, and it's calculated as the difference between all the projected spending. So you put everything on the books. You don't care what it's called. So whether it's called debt service or transfer payments or lunch for the president or defense spending, all those projected expenditures are valued in the present. And then we compare the present value of all that with the present value of all the taxes that are projected to be received to cover that spending. And then if there's any assets, we incorporate those, you know, any financial assets the government has. So if you look at it, the present value of the spending exceeds the present value of the taxes by $199 trillion. So the country is flat broke. It's another way to put this is that it's 53% under finance. We need a 53% immediate and permanent increase in every single federal tax in order to pay our bills through time. And the longer we wait, this is like a credit card bill that's due today. It's not due in 50 years. The longer we wait to deal with this, the bigger the problem gets for our kids, because the bigger the tax hike that's required at that point in the future. So first of all, we have honest fiscal accounting, and then I would get rid of this fiscal gap by fundamentally fixing Social Security, by fundamentally fixing health care. Everybody has a basic plan, but it's done in a way so the country doesn't get driven broke and we still have private provision. And then I would fix taxes fundamentally. Now, all the details of what I'm proposing are laid out in a 157-page book, which is a very, you know, I'm a good writer, as evidenced by the fact that I am a New York Times bestselling author. And so I'm able to explain things to people in pretty simple terms, so it's not 157 boring pages. It should be a page turner. It's free, and all one has to do is go to www.kotlikoff2016.com and just download the book. You can also get it as a Kindle book online at Amazon for like $2. And you'll see exactly what the situation is. I talk not just about those areas of problems, taxes, Social Security, healthcare, but I also talk about banking, how to fix the banks correctly, how to fix our energy policy, how to address education. We're really failing in the education area. I talk about immigration. I talk about social issues. I talk about foreign policy. So this is a complete analysis of what we need to do to fix the country. It's a very serious candidacy. We are on the ballot in two states, which are Louisiana and Colorado. We will be official write-in candidates in all the other states that permit write-in candidates. And so they represented about 92%, 93% of all the electors. So if we win the states where we are running, even if we win most of those states, we will win when I say we, it's myself running for president and Edward Leamer, who's a top economist at UCLA. This is the first time economists have ever run for president and vice president in the history of the country. And what we're trying to get across is the idea that politicians have made a mess. They've made a terrible, they've engaged in deceitful, disgraceful acts of fiscal child abuse that are going to affect our children for the rest of their lives. We need to put a stop to this in the best possible way. And we need to make sure that on the foreign policy side, that we are actually protecting our children's future. Because if you look at North Korea, you'll see that we have a country that already has miniaturized nuclear weapons, which we sat back and let them produce for over a 35-year period of negotiations where they just played us, and they ended up with nuclear bombs that can fit on top of rockets, according to our Air Force, because our Air Force has said this in testimony in Congress, our members of the Air Force. And now they are testing ballistic missiles to hit us, you know, go into space and come back down. And it's just a matter of a few years, I'm sure, before they will be able to reach anywhere in the U.S. They're coming to a theater near you. So as president, I think that's leaving our children at an enormous risk. You know, that and climate change is another example of leaving our children at enormous risk. So fiscally speaking, when it comes to national defense, national security issues, when it comes to the climate, everywhere you see adults, grown-ups ducking their responsibility. And Ed and I are not politicians. We're not running to try and get reelected to hold on to power. We could care less about that. We're not into this for an ego trip, but we actually are parents. We are concerned about our kids and about your kids and everybody's kids in this country. And we think the first definition of an adult is somebody who takes care of his children. And we need to have adults running the country for a change. So that's why I'm running. I'm running to fix the country for our children and to protect our children from foreign threats.
First of all, hat tip for the very ambitious idea you have here. And I think it's fantastic, the two economists running. Hopefully you'll be setting a new trend to where the cognoscenti step up and say, you know, there needs to be some big changes. We need to see some realistic changes. And you certainly accomplished that with the INFORM Act, with numerous Nobel laureates, tens of thousands, if not more, people. But I know there's going to be listeners that are curious. How pragmatic is this idea of reducing the goodies, maybe we can call them, that people receive? I mean, that won't be as appetizing, I think, to the typical American who's struggling to get by every day. How do we sell this to them?
We have to explain right off the bat that what's been promised can't be delivered because the country is that broke. It's not like you had, you know. So what I'm going to do on Social Security, for example, would be to freeze the existing system, pay off everything that's owed under the existing system, and set up a new system for all workers that's fully funded, that's a personal account system that does not involve Wall Street getting a penny, that's progressive, that has the government investing by a computer in all the financial assets of the world and the financial markets of the world that are, you know, major markets, all done on a market-weighted basis where the government guaranteeing a zero real return. So it gives you a guarantee that you'll get back at least what you put in adjusted for inflation. And if we do that, we will have everybody having a solid old age. Right now, that's not the case. And by the way, what I'm proposing is very similar to what's going on in Norway and in Denmark and in Singapore, in countries that are Hong Kong, engaged in responsible retirement policy. That's the kind of system I'm trying to set up, where the government would make contributions on behalf of the poor and the unemployed and the disabled, so that it's progressive, so that we treat the poor better than the rich, but that everybody has an account, and we treat non-working spouses appropriately. They have an equal size account as the working spouse, because there would be sharing of the contributions. So it's actually very, very simple to fix these problems if you're an economist, because you know how to build the bridge. You know, having studied these issues, how to make the reform work with 10 points, with 10 provisions or that can fit on a postcard. So every single reform that I'm talking about, whether it's healthcare, taxes, Social Security, banking, energy policy, education, it can all fit on a postcard, each one. And so you can fix Social Security overnight by freezing the old system, paying off what you owe, and not incurring more liabilities in a system that can't pay the ones it's got. Raising the ceiling in the payroll tax is also essential. But then I've got an entire tax reform, which does some very different things. It introduces a value-added tax, a progressive consumption tax for the rich that only the rich would pay, and it also introduces an inheritance tax, and it gets rid of three taxes that are highly dysfunctional. One is the estate and gift tax. Another is the income tax, the personal income tax. A third is the corporate income tax. So I want to get rid of the corporate income tax because I want the U.S. to be the most tax-friendly place in the world to invest. So we can just have an enormous amount of investment here and get the country moving again in terms of jobs and growth and wages, because it's been flat for like 40 years. So, and then there's another feature of this reform, the tax reform, which is a basic payment to every American of $2,000, man, woman, child. They all get $2,000. So we can... I'm trying to get rid of the welfare system. I have a reform of food stamps. So I'm trying to get rid of things that are telling people that if you earn a dollar, you're going to lose 22 cents in the earned income tax credit, 23 cents in food stamps. You may lose all your Medicaid benefits, or if you're on Obamacare, you'll lose 25 cents in Obamacare subsidies and premium support. You'll have to pay the FICA payroll tax. You'll have to pay state income taxes. You'll have to pay state sales taxes. When you add all this stuff up, the poor are being locked into poverty. They're being told if you earn another dollar, you're going to basically get nothing back or very little. So we need to have everybody in our country facing a 30% tax on working. Everybody, not a dollar, not a 31% or not 29%. Everybody under my tax reform would pay exactly the same rate on working, which is 30%. And because right now we have people paying 80%, 90%, and they're not working because of it. So far, I've told you a few things that you've never heard on any of the debates from any of the candidates. I've told you about our fiscal gap. I've told you about the marginal taxes that people are facing when you really add it all up. That's because you're talking to somebody who's actually, you know, an economist, professional economist, who's an expert in public finance, who's worked in this area. It's not because I'm the smartest person in the world. and far from it. My wife will tell you that in 2 seconds. And you can't have amateur hour running the country. You can't have people that don't know what they're doing designing policy. Just like I'm not in any position to engage in open heart surgery, who have no background in economics, add up. You need to have a grown-up running the country. I'm not the only one that can do this job, but I've decided to step forward. And we're going to be in a position to win the election because we're galvanizing a lot of interest from young college students who are going to be spreading the word. And through time, and we have enough time, I'm having a meeting tonight with 40 supporters. It doesn't, you know, with the internet, it used to be that the parties had to tell us who we could vote for. Now with the internet, we don't need to have the parties because each person is a megaphone. Each person has friends who've got friends who've got friends. They can each make it like a chain letter that's actually a good chain letter, not an evil, malfeasant chain letter. And they can spread the word about Kotlikoff2016.com, get people to read the book, and they'll see that I can fix these things together with Ed Lehmer, my VP candidate, come up with different ways to think about our foreign policy conflicts. You know, we have a big conflict with Russia right now. We have to normalize that relationship, and we have to do it in a give-and-take way because they're very concerned about our taking over Ukraine in the form of it becoming a NATO member. And that's their biggest concern, and they feel, I think for paranoid reasons, that they're being threatened by the U.S. and encircled by the U.S., by NATO. I know a fair amount about Russian feelings on the matter because I work in Russia doing research with a think tank there on the side. I'm a full-time professor at Boston University. I also have a software company, so I do a bunch of things. And one of the things I'm doing is research on global climate change, building models. I go to Russia, and I get to talk to Russians at high and low levels about how they perceive the U.S. and the conflict. So I think I could figure out how to handle the relationship with Russia. China, we need to come up with a solution to the South China Sea, which involves China getting some resolution of its longstanding concern with Taiwan. It could be a 100 or 150-year lease where at some point Taiwan becomes a part of China, and there's the normalization of relationships starting now between Taiwan and China. Just the way Hong Kong was, you know, after a long leasing period with the British, it became part of China. It's not perfect. Not everybody in Hong Kong is happy to be back with China. But this is what's needed to get an agreement so that we don't have a war breakout between us and China over a couple pieces of rock in the South China Sea, which could happen.
I wonder if you've considered the positive impact that you could have if you were to, let's say, become a Fed governor or a Fed chair, attempt to usher in some type of augmentation or improvements to the current Federal Reserve policymaker process.
Well, I think that the big problem with the Fed, there are two big problems with the Fed's behavior. But the Fed is an independent agency, and I would respect its independence. It doesn't mean that the president can't voice his opinion, but it does mean that the president cannot try and have a yes man or yes woman run the Fed. That's not the way our system is supposed to work, and that's not the way I would run it. I would maintain the Fed's independence. Well, it is independent. It's not up for the president to treat it any other way than as an independent agency. But I can voice my views as right now as a private citizen, and I'll just tell you what I think. I think that the Fed has printed an absolutely enormous amount of money since 2007, something like $3 trillion. Just think about how much $3 trillion is. They've printed that to pay Congress's bills, and then they've called this quantitative easing. They've said that they've done all this in order to stimulate the economy. But then they've turned around. If they really wanted to stimulate the economy, they would not be bribing banks not to make loans, which is what they did. They printed up $3 trillion. They bought all kinds of goods and services and made transfer payments to older people, younger people, whatever. They paid the bills with the $3 trillion. And then when people put the money in the bank, the banks were ready to lend it out. And what the Fed did to keep the money out of circulation, to keep inflation from happening, what they did is they told the banks, look, don't lend it out. Give it to us. Give the money back to us, and we'll give you some interest on it. We'll pay you interest.
So they're bribing the banks not to make loans. So none of this is really about stimulating the economy. This is all about paying the government's bills, paying Congress's bills. This is what countries that are third world countries do. When they're broke, they print money. And when they're broke, they don't repair their infrastructure. And we have crumbling infrastructure. We have all kinds of dangerous bridges and railroad bridges and regular highway bridges, car bridges, automobile bridges. We have all kinds of infrastructure problems. You go and look at the Kennedy Airport, you'll see a picture of what out-of-date infrastructure is all about. So we're broke, and you see it in so many different ways, but it's being hidden by the public because of the accounting, because we haven't been telling the truth about, you know, we've been basically cooking the books like Bernie Madoff and Alan Stanford when they ran their Ponzi schemes. You know, whether it's I'm driving in Boston, you see potholes all over the city, you see infrastructure that's crumbling, even though Boston's one of the richest cities, you see the state of Illinois having run a Ponzi scheme, and its pension fund, I think, is about 70% underfunded. You know, Detroit just went bankrupt. You see the city of Camden, a disaster. It used to be I grew up right next to Camden. My dad had the first and last department store. It was a bustling little city. Now it's, you know, a place where nobody would actually dare to walk at night for fear of getting mugged. But there's many, many honest poor citizens who are forced to live with all that violence. So we need to address, the reason they're not being addressed is partly because we're broke. And when countries go broke, they print money. And we've been printing money. So if you put it all together, I would tell the Fed, stop printing money. It's up to the Congress to pay its bills, not up to the Federal Reserve to pay Congress's bills. The other thing is that this low interest rate policy that the Fed's been running hasn't worked. It's not like the economy has come roaring back because of these low interest rates. So whether we raise interest rates, you know, back to where they were or not is not going to matter. The only thing it's going to do is take a lot of poor old people who are living on fixed incomes, who are putting their money into CDs, and give them some income to live on. I think we should go back to higher interest rates, normal interest rates, and I think we should take the focus away from the Fed, because I don't think the Fed is I don't think the Fed's interest rate matters much at all. I think we've had plenty of evidence that it doesn't matter. Sure, if they raise the interest rate to 20%, everybody would get scared. You know, if you really look at what happened to interest rates in 1979 or 78, when Paul Volcker announced that he was going to reduce the growth rate of the money supply, interest rates shot high, sky high the next day. It was all based on expectations of what Volcker was going to do and what other people were going to, how they're going to react to Volcker's statement. In the end, it turned out that Volcker didn't actually do what he said he was going to do. It was just a complete panic, and it drove the economy into recession. So the economy is very prone to go into panic. That's really what happened in the main in 2008. You need to have a president in charge who understands when a panic is happening and knows how to explain to the public, hey, look, this is a panic. And, yeah, you can all decide that we're having you're all in a cramped movie theater, and somebody has just screamed fire, but there's actually no fire. But if you all start screaming, running out the door because of that guy who didn't know what he's talking about, screaming fire, you're going to kill each other. So just stay seated, and we'll check if there's a fire. We'll triple check, but there's no fire. And that's what we could have done in 2008, and we could have prevented that great recession had we had some leadership at the top that actually understood what a panic is about and how to deal with a panic. It doesn't involve getting Congress to pass a $700 billion TARP bill. I mean, think about employers are saying, gee, if Congress has to issue $700 billion to save the economy must be terrible. I better fire my workers tomorrow before my customers stop arriving. And, of course, the workers that he's firing are somebody else's customers. So, and you just multiply that through all the employers around the country, and you have 8.5 million people thrown out of work over 19 months, which is exactly what happened. So having an economist who understands this stuff matters. And so I think the Fed policy should be changed, but I'm not running for president to become a Fed chairman. I'm running, or a Fed, you know, member of the Federal Reserve Board. I'm running for president, and I'm not running for president to stroke my ego or sell more books or help my software company or anything like that. My motive is your kids and my kids, and I'm running to win. And it's a serious campaign, and I believe we will win. All the top leadership, not all of it, but large segments of it are openly saying they're not going to vote for him. This is unprecedented to have a major political nominee, you know, party nominee, huge numbers of his party and very prestigious members desert him and or her. So Trump is melting down, and that's rightfully so. I'm hoping that all the Republicans in the country will adopt my candidacy, and all they have to do in Colorado or Louisiana is just vote for me because I'm on the ballot. In the other states, they have to write on the place provided on the ballot, they have to write Lawrence Kotlikoff for president, so they have to learn how to spell my name, and they have to write Edward Leamer for vice president, and that's that. And then we'll be elected and we'll fix the country. It's not hard for a write-in candidate to win. The reason that you haven't heard of a write-in candidate winning the presidency is there's never been a serious write-in candidate, as far as I can tell. There's never been one who's received the kind of press attention that we've been receiving from the Wall Street Journal and the Dallas Morning News and the Boston Globe and Bloomberg and Business Week and Money and Forbes and Newsmax, Politico. The list just goes on. So Kotlikoff 2016 has all the press, and it's just coming in all the time. This radio interview will be posted up there as well. So this is perfectly feasible. It's not the idea that you have to spend billions of dollars to become a presidential candidate. It's just not the case. I write for Forbes. I'm a blogger for Forbes, if you'll endorse it. Because all I need is a few major Republicans like Steve to endorse my candidacy, and the entire party will flip. It's just that unstable, what we economists call an equilibrium. You've got a tipping point situation here, and the Republicans are going to tip first, I think, in our direction, and then the Democrats are going to tip. I spoke my piece and I explained their policies, taxes. The foreign situation has been very difficult, and there was no perfect answer. He extricated us from Iraq and Afghanistan, and those countries are no-win propositions for us, but we do have to deal with ISIS, and I think he's dealing with that risk pretty well. Where I think he's really falling short is on North Korea and Iran when it comes to missile testing, because we have this deal with Iran, but Iran can turn around and buy a missile from North Korea from one day to the next. They're sitting there ready for shipment and delivery, sitting right there in North Korea. They've been produced, they've been tested, they work. They can be sold to Iran. Iran has missiles that can fly 2,000 kilometers, and in a few years they'll be able to fly 8,000 kilometers and hit New York City. We don't want them testing any more missiles. We need to have a president who comes in and day one says, you put another long-range missile on your launch pad, and it will be gone. It will be destroyed the minute it's up there. Same thing with the North Koreans. You launch another missile of any kind, short or long range, it will be destroyed, because the only way we're going to deal with these rogue regimes is by being very, very tough and clear. Otherwise, in 10 years, we're going to be looking at North Korea having a nuclear weapon that can hit New York City, or at least Honolulu, or Anchorage, or San Francisco. I mean, it's not that far off. They already can, you know, get a missile up into space, they're going to figure this out. If they can figure out how to make a nuclear bomb, they're going to figure out how to get a missile to your doorstep, provide some grown-up leadership for our country on the domestic front and the foreign policy front. Thank you, and I do encourage everybody not just to go to the website, not just to download the book and read it, but to actually volunteer for the campaign, to get involved, and to spread the word about my candidacy, because we don't need the press, we don't need rich donors, we just need the public to care about their children, and we will win.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garnero, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned, with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Welcome back to GoldSeek Radio.
Thank you very much.
Finally, after nearly a decade of holding rates at impossibly low levels, the Fed raised rates. Nevertheless, their counterparts in Europe and in other parts of the world are actually considering going further into negative territory. Do you see this as dollar supportive, and just what might it mean for the global currency world?
Well, I'm aware that just about anyone under the sun is so optimistic about the U.S. dollar. This is a view I do not necessarily share, because I do not expect the Fed to continue increasing rates. On the contrary, I think that sometimes in 2016, the Fed will again cut rates and more likely than not launch QE4.
QE4, I assume that would mean we'd be looking at further monetary easing plans, and we would see the purchase of mortgage-backed securities, credit default swaps, other derivatives, as well as treasuries to hold the market in place. There simply aren't enough buyers worldwide for the U.S. Treasury and for our toxic mortgage debt.
I think the economy is not very responsive any longer. And that applies to all countries in the world, to expansionary monetary policies, because they've been practiced for so long. So the impact is now diminishing. And there are many factors, aside from monetary policies and fiscal policies, that have an impact on the economy. And my sense is that the way the stock market has behaved, where the average stock is down more than 20%, but the indices are still holding up because of just a few stocks, that this is actually quite reflective of the U.S. economy, where a few companies and a few sectors are still doing okay, but the majority of sectors and the majority of people, the median household, the workers, the middle class, isn't doing well at all. So my view would be it's more likely that the U.S. will go into recession within the next 3 months, if we are not yet in a recession, because industrial production is already down, exports are down, imports are down. These are quite powerful indicators. Of course, then the government publishes figures about employment, but these are vastly distorted figures, because if you have one job, you are fired, and then you take two part-time jobs, then statistically one job has been lost, but two have been created. So a lot of statistics are very questionable in the U.S.
You know, underemployment is certainly a big problem, as well as record levels of poverty, or at least near poverty, with approximately 50 million Americans accepting food stamps to help keep dinner on the table. We also have other leading indicators, economic indicators, that are flashing at least yellow. Manufacturing rollover heavily in the United States, which tends to precede a recession.
Yes, the signs are all there that unlike all the strategists and economists who a year predicted a strengthening U.S. economy and a healing of the global economy, we have actually in most emerging markets already a recession or no growth or a very severe growth slowdown, with some sectors being in recession. All the economies in the world that depend on resources are basically in a recession. And in the U.S., and I wrote about this already 4 years ago, we have nowadays an economy and a social system that has a lot of resemblances to a banana republic.
We also have a bifurcated economy, I think you alluded to earlier. On the one hand, we see the Dallas Fed Manufacturing Index plunging to lows not seen in years, another leading indicator. But then on the other, we see the retail sector holding up surprisingly well. Strength in retail, could that be correlated to perhaps higher debt levels, giving us the illusion of strength in that sector?
Well, I mean, we have to analyze how well retail is holding up. Because if I look at all the retail stores in the U.S., the performance of their stocks has been horrible. Horrible, not just bad, but horrible. And now someone can come and say, well, this is due that people buy now online, and so the traditional retailers are all suffering and so forth. I don't buy this argument entirely. What has been strong in retailing and in consumption has been, for instance, auto sales. And auto sales have been driven largely by credit. We have now a car loan industry that is over $1 trillion, car loans. And what has also been strong are home improvement items. In other words, the Home Depots have done well. But this has also a lot to do with the fact that people don't buy homes anymore, but they improve their existing homes. Or parents, they need some new furniture for their siblings who will stay at home, can't afford an apartment anymore. So this is also a debatable statistic whether that is so healthy.
We also have had difficulty in the energy sector. West Texas Intermediate crude plunging into low 30s perhaps on its way to the 20s. That is good for the consumer, the largest component of our domestic economy. But then, of course, you also have the difficulties that stem from the large number of energy sectors in the S&P 500 weighing heavily on that sector, and, of course, jobs as well. Any comments on the energy sector?
Well, I mean, this country with the largest industrial sector as a percent of GDP is South Korea. But the problem is that South Korea doesn't benefit much from falling commodity prices because their exports to commodity producers, including the Middle East, are larger than their exports to the EU and the US combined. So when the customers have less money, they also buy less from South Korea. And so net, the benefit actually is very, very minor or even negative. In the case of South Korea, December exports were down 13%. In the U.S., the consumer would be a prime beneficiary from low energy prices. Unfortunately, the U.S. has a president that found it necessary that for most people, insurance premiums are rising by 20, 30, 40% per annum at the present time. And, you know, for people who have a lot of money, say you make $1 million a year, it doesn't matter whether your health insurance premium goes up by 30%. But if you're a family of four and middle class or working family, it makes a big difference. And if you have a car, yes, you benefit from lower oil prices, but if at the same time the tunnel fees, the toll roads, and the tolls at bridges all go up by double digits, it doesn't help you very much. So all these things have been offset to a large extent by extremely poor policies by the U.S. government.
The precious metals, a lot of aficionados in the audience here today. Higher rates ahead doesn't seem to bode too well for the metal, at least in the United States. But then with your forecast of perhaps Fed officials and policymakers having to backpedal, that might be the panacea that the precious metals bulls need.
Well, first of all, we had already a bear market in gold of more than 40% since September 2001. In other words, the bear market is more than 4 years old. Gold, compared to other assets, to stocks, bonds, and most currencies, in my view, is not particularly expensive. And the gold shares have started to outperform other stocks. And so I'm actually quite optimistic for gold to perform better than the S&P and better than other indices in 2016. In fact, I think that sentiment has been so negative recently about gold and gold shares that there is a significant upside potential. That would be my view. I'm not sure it's good news. But good news, basically, for someone who wants to buy gold would be for the gold price first to decline and provide a great buying opportunity, you understand? But I think already here it's at a very attractive level. So I bought some additional gold. Of course, I always buy gold, but on this weakness in the last month, I increased my position.
With the shocking increase in yields, it certainly doesn't seem to bode well for the debt and bond sector. Of course, stocks under pressure worldwide with Chinese policymakers and officials putting the brakes, their Shanghai index at least last week. You're obviously becoming a little more sanguine regarding the yellow metal. Do you see other interesting opportunities ahead in the commodities sector?
Yes. I mean, the same analysts who a year ago or 2 years ago were predicting oil to go to $150. Now they say it will go to 20. I don't know whether it will go to 20 or not, but my sense is that between this level 2020, the market is very inexpensive. And my view would be that we could have a sharp rebound. Maybe not, maybe, most likely not to new highs, but say to an equilibrium price of between, say, $40 and $60, maybe $70. So, yes, I think in the commodities complex, there are now opportunities. I have to say that for individuals to play the commodity markets is not that simple. First of all, they need a futures account. And many people in the U.S., they don't want to have a futures account or they don't know how to open one. Then they buy ETFs, commodity ETFs. Commodity ETFs are just about the worst investment anyone can ever make because the rollover cost is far too high. So if a commodity, if you buy a commodity ETF and the commodity doesn't go up 30% in a year, you will probably lose money. Physical gold, the storage cost is relatively low and you can buy physical gold and you don't have to roll it over. So I would buy, if you really believe in a commodities rebound, my belief would be that precious metals would actually outperform other commodities.
And it also has the added benefits of avoiding rehypothecation and related issues that have come up all over the world. Not to mention potential confiscation issues, margin-related problems, and just a time where regulations and policies are coming into place that I think the typical investor may not be prepared for. The middle class used to be the backbone, if you will, of societies in the Western world, and it really was the aspiration of the working classes that their progeny might reach the goal of the middle class. That was really the dream that drove, I think, so much of the economic, and still does today to some extent. But we've just seen at least erosion of the middle class in the United States, maybe not so much in China and other BRIC nations. Can you give tips to the American middle class listeners today to help improve their economic situation?
Well, when I look back at the 50s and 60s, and how rich Americans were relative to the rest of the world. I'm talking here relative. American workers, they earned a lot of money. They could go to Europe on holidays and live in Europe far above the life standard of Europeans because the dollar at the time was very strong. It bought over $4 Deutschmark and 4 Swiss francs, whereas now it buys exactly about 1 Swiss franc. So a lot of things have changed in the world. We have, in the Western world, not just in the U.S., a generation of people that will die poorer and earn less in real terms, inflation adjusted, than their parents in the 50s and 60s, whereas in emerging economies, I can say that in China, we didn't have a middle class 30 years ago. And if I measure, say, a middle class, a simple indicator would be how many people can go on holidays and how many people can buy a car and so forth. So in China, for instance, in the mid-80s, there were less than 5 million Chinese traveling overseas. They were not allowed. And then by year 2000, there were 10 million Chinese traveling overseas. And now there are 120 million Chinese traveling overseas every year. With a shift in the balance of economic power, and it is, say, sad for me to see that the Western world has lost, relatively speaking, so much in such a brief period of time. And the only explanation I have for this loss in relative prosperity in such a short period of time are, and I can't use the word I would like to use, the governments idiotic policies and their interventions into free markets and with monetary policies that then lead to essentially an enrichment of few people, very few people, not 1%, 0.01%, and essentially an impoverishment of the majority of people. The media, they have been bought by the government, or their owners are bought by the government. They will always paint a nice picture of what is happening in the economy, because they just watch the stock market and they watch Wall Street and New York that lives essentially from tourists, and the money printing that flows first into the financial sector. So, of course, there is a trickle-down effect in New York, but it hasn't really reached Main Street.
Perhaps you'd like to share with us a brief overview of your perspective on the year 2016, this new year.
Well, I think I mentioned before in interviews, I don't think the stock market will go up and that it will close lower and that we will drop between 20 and 40% from the May 2015 high, S&P 2,134. However, I'm not the clairvoyant about what the Fed will do and other central banks. I think, as I mentioned in just now, that the Fed will embark on QE4, but to really have an impact and push markets to new highs, they will have to do a massive QE4. I would imagine in the order of $150 billion asset purchase every month. And whether politically that will be acceptable is debatable, because the elections are coming up.
Well, thanks again, Dr. Faber, for another excellent economic overview. We wish you an excellent 2016.
Thank you very much.